Well, I know what we're going to talk about today, but first let's introduce you. I already did that when you were off the air, but I'll say that you're the founder of the Southampton-based Prevention First Healthcare, and this is indeed a revolutionary practice, and you focus on patients' proactive wellness, no wait times. Astounding. That's a plus. No wait times. Patients even have access to your personal cell phone. That's another one. And if anyone is interested in finding out, you've got a half hour free consultation. And all they have to do is call 215-PREVENT. And if you're computer savvy, you call online 215prevent.com. And that's the deal. Now, today we're going to be talking about cholesterol. And should we be worried about our cholesterol numbers? Yes or no?
Well, I read an interesting quote, and it said that high cholesterol is a silent disease.
Mm-hmm.
That people don't really know they're walking around with high cholesterol. But what happens is, as that cholesterol, which is the fat, as your triglycerides, builds up in the walls of our arteries, it's the blood vessels that supply blood to the brain, the heart, the kidneys, and all of our vital organs, over time, if it's not treated, then it narrows the blood supply and it builds up plaque, which is basically, think of it like rust in a pipe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of two things happens. Either that rust or plaque, if you will, builds up and stops circulation to the brain, the heart, the kidneys, the eye, the legs, our vital organs, or the plaque can rupture and a clot forms, and that leads to a heart attack or a stroke. So while high cholesterol is theoretically silent, as it builds up, the effects, the ultimate effects, certainly are not silent and can be life-threatening.
Well, you know, there's good cholesterol and there's bad cholesterol. Now, what's the difference?
Well, if you look at the total numbers, there's actually many, many, many different forms of cholesterol. The ones that people are commonly familiar with is the total cholesterol, and that's made up of something called the good cholesterol, which is HDL, and that is sort of a scavenger. It's a protein complex that goes through the body, and it pulls cholesterol off of the lining. It's like basically our own internal Roto-Rooter. It goes to clean our arteries out. So the more high cholesterol you have, or HDL, the better. So sometimes a patient will have a total cholesterol over 200. Normal is considered 200. Anything over that is high. So someone may have a cholesterol that's 220, 230, and they're panicked. Oh, doctor, this is bad. And I'll say, well, wait, your good cholesterol is so high. That's what's making up a lot of the number. So it's really not bad. The other type of cholesterol that people commonly hear about is the LDL.
Yeah.
You can think of L for lousy, or bad cholesterol. And that's the one that doctors tend to focus on the most. And the reason is that's the one that seems to correlate very closely with coronary artery disease, with blocked arteries.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one called non-HDL cholesterol, which is a measurement. These are attained mathematically. And when people go to the doctor, it can be explained to them it's an actual number. And that looks into all of the other types of bad cholesterol circulating in the blood that build up on the walls of arteries, and also has a very high correlation with developing coronary disease, stroke, and heart attack.
Well, you know, it's interesting that we're talking about this today, because every now and then you hear about somebody young having a massive heart attack and they're gone. And then people will say, no, like my first question, well, would he have heart disease or high blood pressure? No, he was healthy. So this is what you're talking about, too. This is a silent thing that's going on in people's bodies sometimes. Is that correct? I mean, what?
Well, absolutely. And there's different.
Yeah.
The recommendations are that people, adults, should get their cholesterol checked when they go to the doctor. Now, one of the things we do in our practice is every patient gets an hour and a half physical, and sometimes it runs longer than that. And a large portion of it every year is updating family history, because things change in your family every single year, and it may affect your health. But if the doctor only sees you for the 6 to 10 minutes that you get in an American medical visit, and often you're not even getting a doctor, you're getting a surrogate who's basically there to sort of fix a problem but not really address preventatively what your future is going to be, it's a problem. So we sit down with people for an hour and a half, and I ask them about every family member. One of the things we look for is any indication that somebody has had cardiovascular disease, stroke, heart attack diseases of the arteries, what they call PAD, of the legs, and particularly if it occurs at a young age. I think that most people, is that when they become adults, should have a fasting cholesterol tested. And then, depending upon what you read, have it followed up on every several years. It can be, if you're young, every 5 years. If you're older, every 1 to 2 years. But things change. And the whole goal of preventative medicine is to catch things at the earlier stages. I can tell you from my own personal family history, I have an uncle that had a what's called a familial hyperlipidemia, meaning he had a genetic defect that produced massive amounts of cholesterol. His body didn't get rid of it. Mm-hmm. And it built up into yellow plaques that were seen on his elbows and under the eyes. And that's called xanthelasma. That's really bad.
I've
and
seen that.
In 1968, time, there was no treatment for that. My uncle had a massive heart attack and died.
Oh.
But there are people that still walk around with that. And if you don't get it checked, then unfortunately people, you know, will get sudden death or they'll get a heart attack. And we have great treatment for it.
You do?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, back in the I guess the late 80s, a drug called Mevacor was invented. And that was revolutionary because it stops the body from actually manufacturing cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
And then since that, there have been many, many other drugs. I believe there are 7 that are called statin drugs on the market that significantly lower cholesterol. And very recently, within the past, I would think, month to 2 months, the FDA recently approved 2 new drugs that are injectable. Because what happens with treating cholesterol, some people will get horrible muscle aches from statin drugs. Sometimes they get muscle aches to the point that it actually destroys the muscle. You need to be hospitalized. Mm-hmm. So what do you do with people like that? Now, before we used to use niacin, which may or may not be so good and often causes flushing. We used to use things that cause constipation and drugs that weren't as good as the what are called statin drugs. But now we have things that are injectable. They're actual monoclonal antibodies. And the way they work is they bind a protein that the body makes.
Mm-hmm.
And the protein was only discovered now within the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. We never knew about it before. I was in medical school. We didn't know about this protein.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called a PCKS9 protein.
Mm-hmm.
So the antibody, the shot you get in the arm, binds that. And what happens is it allows the liver to clear all the cholesterol from your bloodstream. So it's a remarkable medicine. And it, for people that have been told, sorry, there's nothing left for me to do, you can't tolerate statins, or what's confounding the physicians is we do everything right as the doctor. We order the right medicines. We get their numbers to come down to where we think they're supposed to be according to guidelines. And then the patient still has a heart attack or still clogs off their coronaries. What do you do with those people?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we have really good treatment for it. But once again, you need to come to the doctor. You need to get the cholesterol checked. You need the family history updated. And you need time with the doctor. And that's what we do at Prevention First Healthcare.
Well, let me just say this first of all. Isn't cholesterol manufactured in the liver?
Yes.
So then what does it mean when people go on low-fat or no-fat diets and this and that and the other thing, and they still have cholesterol? So is it a hereditary problem or a genetic problem? What is the reason? I mean, I know that, you know, personally, there's low cholesterol in my family, even when people are overweight.
Well, a lot of it does depend on the genes. And one of the fascinating things about medicine is that the human genome was finally decoded a number of years ago. But since that time, there's been an explosion of information.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's many things in medicine where we don't have a crystal ball, that we go based upon research, current thinking, common sense, as to what the right thing to do is. And every so many years, there are commissions called the Joint National Commission, where doctors and scientists look at the data and they look and see what have the studies shown. And about a year or two ago, there was a conference like that, which changed thinking. And what it led to was the belief that we're not treating enough people with statin drugs. And what used to happen was we used to base treatment on what's called risk factors. So a risk factor would be diabetes, high blood pressure, family history of somebody getting a stroke or heart attack at a young age, smoking, things like that. And any age, and based upon that, you would sort of fit the LDL cholesterol into different groups and decide on whether or not you would treat. And what they found out is that that may not be effective. We may be missing people. So they've grouped the classification into basically four. And three of these groups automatically get put on a statin. One is anybody with a fasting LDL or bad cholesterol greater than 190. Number two, anybody with type 2 diabetes or type 1 diabetes. And number three, anybody that has already exhibited any evidence of cardiovascular disease, meaning they've already had angina, a blocked carotid, a stroke, a heart attack. And then you have the rest of the group. And what they suggest doing is taking people's risk factors and putting them into a calculator, which people can do online. It's called a 10-year risk calculator, and it's part of the National Institutes of Health. The only thing a person would have to know, they would have to know their good and their total cholesterol, their good cholesterol, and what their top number, their blood pressure is. And if they knew those three things, a person could do this at home. If not, your doctor can do it if they have time. Once again, this is one of the things we do in our practice, is we sit with a patient with a computer in real time and figure out risk. And the thinking is, if the risk is greater than 7.5%, then that patient should be put on a statin drug, but not to lower the number to a certain place, but to reduce it by up to 20 to 40%.
That's kind of interesting. So, but, you know, you hear about these, what do you call them, naturopaths, or you know what I'm talking about, the people that practice vitamin therapy and that sort of thing. They'll say that there's so many bad side effects to statin drugs.
I'll say there's so many bad side effects to stroke and heart attack and death. that's a really bad side effect. And you know, with anything in medicine, there's a risk-benefit ratio. We don't come to work to kill people. We come to work to save lives.
That's right.
If a person can't tolerate the statin drug, then, you know, certainly there's alternatives.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. Just to run one, how confounding medicine can be. I have a man that comes to me who's really in great shape. He takes no medicines. He's fit. He's a college professor. In his 60s, and was claiming that he was doing everything by the book. And Pat, we had him on four different over-the-counter type medicines, right? Yeast rice, fish oil pills, flaxseed oils, and we could not get his cholesterol down. And what we did was we sent him for something called a cardiac CAT scan. And what it did was it went to look, does this man actually even have any plaque in his heart, in his blood vessels? And he had zero. And what came out later was, due to a hospitalization for something completely unrelated, was he wasn't being completely frank with me over what he really ate. And when he sort of came clean with what his real dietary habits were, and we were able to provide him with education. By the way, this is a college professor. So, and even myself as a physician, I don't know everything.
Right.
I read every single day. I look at research every single day.
Right.
And I learn every day. I learn from my patients. But look, many people can be managed with red yeast rice, which is over the counter. Not everybody needs a statin. People can be managed with some fish oil, with niacin. It's what we used to use. So you really have to personalize your care to that of the patient.
Well, now, what was it that he ate that was so bad?
Oh, he was eating, his son was an up-and-coming baseball player, so he was eating hot dogs. He was eating fried food. He was eating French fries.
Oh, there you go.
And not thinking about it, didn't realize maybe this is bad. And I think we all have habits like that. I think everybody will reach for something and sort of, because they're hungry or it's expedient, and that's sort of not realize, maybe that's not so good for me. And once in a while, you're probably fine. But when it becomes a staple of your diet, then bad things start to happen.
Now, what about, go back to the injectable medication thing again. Is it more effective than statin drugs we take by mouth?
Well, it's originally was designed to be used in people that have heart disease, and they either cannot tolerate the statin drug they're on to the effective dose. So I'll give you an example. Let's say you're trying to get a patient that we know has coronary disease and maybe diabetes to get their LDL somewhere between 50 and 70. and you put the patient on a statin, you can pick one of seven, and you try them, and you can't do it. The patient is unable to tolerate enough of the medicine to get his bad cholesterol to what we think the goal should be. Then you can add on this medication. Or a patient that continues to suffer with heart attacks or angina, requiring angioplasties, and you have them on a maximal amount of a potent statin, and you still can't get their LDL cholesterol low enough. That's when these drugs are used. Or for a person that's completely intolerant, meaning they've taken statins, but it's damaged their muscles, and they absolutely can't take any kind of a statin, those are the people that these drugs are used on.
There you go. Let me just ask you this one question, too. How significant is obesity in this?
Well, obesity is very significant. I mean, you know, obesity was classified as a disease. And remember, this is affecting two-thirds of the American population.
Right.
Two-thirds of our population are overweight or obese. And what happens is by making poor food choices, people gain excess body weight. And I remember I was at one conference and they called it the Homer Simpson syndrome, is that you look at Homer Simpson with, you know, a big belly, and that's what he's doing is storing triglycerides, which are another form of fat, and that makes a beeline right to your coronary arteries, right to your brain, and clogs off your arteries.
Well, you know, what is that? Is that the metabolic syndrome that people talk about?
Yes.
Because
that's excellent. That's exactly what it is. It's people that have a high triglyceride, low HDL, and they'll have centripetal obesity, meaning they look like Homer Simpson. And, you know, it's interesting, if you think about, well, Marge actually isn't built like that, but Homer is. And if you want to do an experiment, if somebody takes a tape measure, for a man, the waist circumference is supposed to be less than 40 inches, and for a woman, less than 35.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not, then you're at risk for heart disease.
Yikes. But, you know, there are hereditary factors to this, too. I mean, how many people do we know that are either the apple or the pear?
Oh, absolutely.
And they're both overweight, but they're just pears. You know, they look kind of thin around the waist.
No. I agree. I mean, I've gone to conferences where they've said there are people that no matter what they do, can't seem to keep a normal body weight, and they end up having to eat food or basically very high-protein diets, very calorie-restricted to maybe 1,400 or 1,500 calories a day, which is not really a lot of food for an active person in order to maintain a normal body weight. But, you know, the interesting thing about practicing medicine is things are always change. Thinking changes, research changes, our information changes. And if people don't come to the doctor, how are they going to get the benefit of that? And the way medicine is changing, you know, I'm not going to get political, but it's hard not to turn on the news or the television or read the paper and, you know, understand it's going to be a presidential year next year. But one of the things they don't really talk about or address is that the United States has the highest mortality in the industrialized world. We come in last. We're 34th. We're tied with Serbia. Yet we're spending $2.8 trillion a year. And the most basic thing, coming to a doctor, isn't really addressed. I mean, they say it's being addressed, but there's not enough doctors.
Well, that's why I like your practice. It's prevent.
Well, it is, and it really does provide longevity. And we make a big difference. I sit with patients every day, and they just thank me for my time. And it's just old-fashioned medicine. It's old-fashioned Marcus Welby medicine. Mm-hmm. You sit there, you listen to your patient, and when there are problems, I do it all day long. I am on the phone with all the local experts, local specialists. So my patients are treated well. They get seen by doctors right away. And when they walk into another doctor's office, they know why they're there. Most times people have a problem, they go to their doctor, and the doctor has, you know, allotted 6 to 10 minutes. That's all he has. And then he hands them a note. Here, go see the specialist. Well, now they have to wait weeks or months to see the specialist. They walk into the specialist's office. Specialist says, why are you here? I don't know. My doctor sent me. Well, now the specialist has to figure it out. And now he has to order more tests, get more records, and it's just basically wasting people's time. When if they came to a practice like mine, they would get all the time they need with me. I then get on the phone, and Pat, my network extends to the Mayo Clinic, it extends to Harvard, it extends to the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, mm-hmm. University of Pennsylvania, and to all the local physicians at our wonderful local community hospitals. And we solve problems. We get people better. We save lives.
Well, this seems like the right way to go. But now, what's created the big problem in medicine? I can remember, like you said, it's old-fashioned medicine, what you do. But now, who decides that you've only got 10 minutes with a patient? Where does that come from?
Well, what's happened is I remember being in high school, and I'm a product of the Philadelphia Public High Schools, mm-hmm. and learned about something called the Law of Diminishing Returns. And what happens is that, going back 40 years ago, you went to a doctor, the visit was a reasonable charge, the doctor didn't have a high overhead, and you paid him cash. And if the doctor gets busy or his electric bill went up, he charged an extra dollar for the visit, and it was really affordable to everybody. And then Medicare gets involved and says, well, now we're now going to control what a doctor earns. And in the beginning, I think it was a very fair amount of money for specialists, for internists, for family doctors. And then I guess they figured, since doctors don't fight back, we're just going to dial it down. And then they began putting more restrictions. I don't think people realize when they go to one in the emergency room, there is something called interqual, so that the doctor has to go to a computer and plug in their numbers. And if they're not sick enough by the numbers, they don't get admitted. Or if they're not sure, they can be called, put on something called an observation status, which now means you're paying up to $500 a day, and what's technically an outpatient status, until they can figure out what's wrong with you. And you're getting basically, I think, the same care, but the hospital makes less money and the doctor makes less money. We get letters, my partner showed me one, that Medicare said that even though we report all of our information, we're totally computerized, we're completely compliant with the government and everything, they change the rules. It's basically like showing up to play Monopoly, but somebody changed mm-hmm. the rules on you. How can you win? So you constantly lose, and then you have to learn different rules, and then they're changed again.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what doctors are facing that the public doesn't realize. And so what's happened is anybody that can get out of medicine is doing it as quickly as possible. The malpractice crisis
in
the last 15 or 20 years killed medical practices, so the overhead skyrocketed, people leave. Pretty much everybody, almost 75% of the doctors, will be employed by someone. Well, if you're working for someone, they want you seeing lots of volume. So if you're seeing lots of volume, how much time do you have? You get 6 to 10 minutes.
Yikes.
And I often tell people, can you take your car to the mechanic and walk in and say, Bob, got to fix my car. Figure out what's wrong. Get it up and running. I'm going to give you 6 to 10 minutes. And by the way, make sure you don't make any mistakes. They would tell you to go someplace else. But yet we ask doctors to do that.
Well, you know what else, too, though? The doctors, it compounds the problem, because the doctors that do take time with the patients, they have an inordinate amount of wait time.
Oh, of course. In fact, before I changed my practice, my patients would wait 2 hours in the waiting room.
Oh,
now, I
my
never
God.
Should,
I'd be
never
screaming.
Find a patient on this earth that will ever tell you, doctor, we're going to let's rush them. I don't rush anybody, never have, never will. But what happens is, when you're trying to do a great job and you're scheduled, even back then we were scheduled every 15 minutes, the patient gets shortchanged.
Yeah,
and
they do.
And you can't do it. So when we change things, now patients get half an hour minimum. Sometimes if they need it, I give them a little bit more. Hour and a half physicals, usually 2 hours, and I'm on my phone morning, noon, and night. I came into my office hours this morning because I have patients that come to me from New York. People come to me from Lewis, Delaware. They come to me from Florida, and I'm on the phone arranging their care, so that they are getting different care.
Wow. Good for you. Now, tell us about, all they have to do is call 215-PREVENT, correct? For
correct.
A free consultation.
215-PREVENT, or call online at 215-PREVENT.com.
Okay, now, here's the thing. People, what is the system different than we do now in our own places that we go, wherever we go? What do you do? Do they pay an upfront fee, and then they have access to you when they have visits?
Well,
do they still pay for an office visit? How does it work?
Well, let me just say that the extra services that we provide, and my staff, remember, my staff makes all of the patients' appointments for them, so that my patients not only don't wait to see me, they don't wait to see anybody, because there's a certain, there's a certain urgency. When a doctor or a doctor's office calls and says, listen, I have a problem with somebody and I need to solve it quickly to save their life. How can we do this? And this is done, by the way, back to me from specialists. People will come to a specialist with some problem and the specialist say, look, that's really not what I do. We got to get you to see Dr. Rabinowitz. And they call me, and we turn over heaven and earth to get people taken care of promptly and to solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
But
if they come for an office visit, that's paid for by their insurance or...
Correct.
Okay.
For standard things that carry a diagnosis code, but for many of the preventative things that we do, particularly 2 hours of time, that can't be billed to an insurance company or a government.
Mm-hmm.
For the staff to get on the phone and to call people, Pat, I will tell you, we have had people on our way to get their cars broken down. My staff goes to get them. A patient's at home who's an accountant during tax season, has a kidney stone, and can't get out to the pharmacy. My staff goes to the pharmacy and drives the medicine to his
terrific.
House.
It's terrific.
So these are things that you can't go billing an insurance company for that.
No. But that is old-fashioned.
Well, no, it is old-fashioned. And basically, anybody that can afford to walk into Starbucks can clearly afford, and their whole family, to come to me. That's how cheap it is. It's less than $4 a day.
Mm-hmm.
And
for a family.
You know, God forbid anybody should smoke. We'll get you off the cigarettes, and they'll save thousands and thousands of dollars
okay.
a year. Now, what the studies show is it's an investment in their health. What it shows is that they actually had a pocket save $1,100 because they're healthier, they're thinner, they're taking less medication, they're seeing the doctor less frequently.
You're right. It's excellent. Excellent. We're going to be talking to you again. You'll be on tomorrow morning, correct?
Yes.
What time? About
8:30.
8:30. Okay. 215 Prevent, Dr. Mark Rabinowitz. You're in Southampton. Where exactly? Southampton's a big place.
Right at the corner of at 2nd Street Pike and Street Road.
That's good.
Yeah, I'm walking distance from there.
That's
Cherry Lane.
Cherry Lane, that's good. I think I know where you are. All right, Dr. Rabinowitz, thank you so much.
Thank you for everything.
Thank you. Thank you for all your good work. Okay, bye-bye. All right, it really is, to me, I think it's a wave of the future. I really do. We keep saying it's old-fashioned medicine, but it's the wave of the future. Because I'm telling you, one of the things I noticed personally a long time ago, I went to this certain gynecologist, obstetrician for a long time. He's been retired. He's a great guy. He's retired now. But I noticed that after a while, he went in with a university. I think his practice, instead of being on his own, he was in with a university. And I am telling you, he would stand with his chart by the door when I was trying to talk to him about something. You know, you get an exam and da-da-da. And then he would stand, like, ready to go. And it was no time at all. Now, my personal doctor now does not do that. But he's got a lot of patients and... But anyway, but he's a terrific guy, and he spends a lot of time. But I think when you're in with these hospital groups or whatever, they, just like Dr. Rabinowitz said, they say, you know, you got to have volume. So people have to be in and out of there. But if you have a doctor that is kind of concerned about you and wants to talk to you, then the other people are waiting in the waiting room. I've been in my doctor's office and waited so long that I had to come back here and do the radio and just leave. But he's a great guy, and they're all good. But I like this type of thing. And